At a meeting last week, more than 100 people heard from Canadian campaigner Alex Schadenberg, chair of Euthanasia Prevention Coalition, and Dr. Duncan Gehry, consultant geriatrician. The meeting was organised by Manx Duty of Care, an informal group of Manx health and social care workers opposed to assisted suicide and euthanasia. What motivated Alex Schadenberg to get involved in campaigning against euthanasia?
I got involved in the euthanasia issue in the 90s already. That was a very long time. I'm not that old, but I got into this when I was very young. And one of the reasons was that in Canada, we were debating euthanasia assisted suicide already because we had several cases, right? We had one case go to the Supreme Court of Canada, et cetera. I'm not going to go into that. But we have a son who's autistic. And so my wife and I were getting involved in the autism community. One of the reasons we were doing that was we were trying to get services for our son. And one of the ways to do that is to get involved in the whole community with the autistic community. And the issue of euthanasia, assisted suicide, hit me totally differently, coming from the point of view of understanding the life experience of people with disabilities. And there were very few people talking about this issue from the opposition point of view. There are lots of people who are opposed to it, but very few actually talking about it. And so I started talking about it and getting involved in that, and I've been doing this ever since. It's a very long time.
And the organization that you're now chair of, I think, is it?
Well, I'm the executive director in Canada. I'm the international chair, so the groups of people who are involved worldwide, I work together with them across the world. And so that's one of the reasons why I do a lot of the traveling, because I'm working in that sense. And I also write constantly. If you go to my articles, you'll see that I'm constantly commenting on what's happening everywhere in the world on this issue. So, but my concerns with the whole issue, whether it be the Isle of Man or Canada or Australia, or you might name it, the place, Scotland, whatever, is the fact that a lot of people discuss this issue based on this whole sort of theory, this concept of, you know, we can have this, we can keep this very limited, it only be for the few cases. And, you know, and it's sold to us all on this concept of, well, we're going to eliminate suffering. And, you know, I'm a human being, I don't want to suffer, I know you don't want to suffer. But the reality of it is a totally different story. And when you start getting into the reality of the human experience, when you've legalized this, and how it affects society in general, and the cases of people who are living in poverty, the cases of people with disabilities, the homelessness issues, and how they're dying by euthanasia in my country of Canada, you start realizing that's a road you shouldn't be going down.
And yet, the mover of the bill, Dr. Allinson, will say very clearly that there are safeguards in place. The bill does ensure that only those people who have
Well, the six-month prognosis is what he's talking about, and he's saying that two doctors would have to approve. But the two doctors approving is really not an issue because, you know, the fact is in Canada, there aren't that many doctors that are actually really involved with doing euthanasia, but doctors are being forced to refer for it. So it doesn't take that many willing to do it in order for you to have a lot of deaths. And the second thing is the second doctor signing off. Well, if you look at the Canadian experience, the doctor who does the assessment and approves it, they never send the person to somebody or get the second assessment done by someone who's maybe not supportive. So you see that the sign-off is always the same, you know, the approvers and the sign-off are always the same people. And so it doesn't take that many physicians willing to do the act in order to have a huge number of deaths, because of how the system forces it in that way. But the other thing is, in Canada, that's exactly what we were also told in Canada. We were told there's going to be safeguards in this. We will not be like the Netherlands and Belgium, where there have been stories that have been very uncomfortable for us to read, because those cases, you look at that and say, well, how did they approve that death? How could this have happened? You see this in some of the Dutch media, some of these stories. And we were told that that was not going to happen in Canada. And in fact, we're surpassing them. So, you know, that's exactly the reality.
So, how can that happen, I suppose, is the question that many people would be listening, would be asking. I mean, they will say, well, okay, the law's passed, it's in black and white, surely that's it.
Well, it's not it, because, you know, you have this problem being human beings, that we all go through difficult times of our life for different reasons. So in Canada, we had the situation where the original law said you had to be terminally ill. But that was declared to be a form of discrimination, once legalized, right? To legalize they had to make sure it was for people who were terminally ill. But once it was legalized, the argument was, well, what about the person who's going through chronic pain but are not terminally ill? Why can they not have it? And, well, once you're already doing it, now the whole goalpost moves. So it becomes an issue of equality and discrimination. So you can't treat someone differently. It's not right. It becomes a question of, well, is it okay to discriminate against this person because they're not terminally ill? And the answer was no. So now we're talking about euthanasia for children in Canada. And the exact same arguments have been made. Is it not discrimination to deny someone who's not 18 years old a legal procedure? Well, under that argument, you're absolutely right. That is discrimination to deny someone under the age of 18 a legal euthanasia. Yeah, you're right. That is discrimination. But you can't justify not doing it once you've already legalized. Before you legalize it, you can talk about all your safeguards and everything else, and it seems reasonable because you haven't legalized this yet. But once you've crossed that line and legalized, now the question is the application of it.
And you know, the again, those in favour, and you know, there are significant numbers on the Isle of Man in favour of introducing this legislation. Yep. We are told from various opinion polls that this significant proportion of the population support this. Should they be denied a right to choose?
Okay, there's two issues here. The first thing is I just wrote about that very issue today, opinion polls and what they mean. Because if you ask someone a hard case scenario, you know, a person who's terminally ill and suffering, and they often will say suffering uncontrolled, which shouldn't ever happen anyway. Nonetheless, if you ask them that specific question, they're going to answer that specific question. But that is not the same scenario as asking them, should we then allow euthanasia also for people who are living in poverty? How about the people with disabilities? What about people with mental illness? What about children? You know, these are whole other questions that you now lead into once you've already gone ahead and legalized. The second question is my right to die per se? And it's a misnomer question because it's assuming that I have the full control over this. And how the law actually works is the doctor is the one who's actually doing the act. So this isn't an issue of autonomy per se. This is an issue of changing the law to give your doctors, and in Canada, nurses also, having the right in law to kill you. And that's what it is. So you might ask for it. That's absolutely true. But there's many reasons why you as a human being might be going through a difficult time and might ask for it. The real issue is, should your doctor ever have the right in law to kill you? And that's a whole other question, I think, because now you're dealing with human beings who are clearly imperfect. And you might get pretty serious problems. Earlier, the doctor presenting tonight was referring to Shipman. So if you would say, we should give Harold Shipman the right to do this, you would say that'd be a crazy idea. But how do you not know you're not doing that already?
One of the things I think that certainly shocked the audience this evening was your case studies, and there were plenty of those, which were, well, you would imagine that those who introduced the law wouldn't have imagined such cases could happen.
Correct. And in fact, my presentation tonight is a short version because I was told I had 25 minutes. So there's tons of stories out of Canada. There's a huge number of stories out of Canada. And what we're seeing is you're seeing how, because you're allowing euthanasia based on having an irremediable medical condition, that people with disabilities now essentially qualify for euthanasia almost all the time, medical assistance in dying. And so, well, a lot of these people are living in poverty, or they're experiencing homelessness, or they're experiencing a situation where they're having a hard time obtaining effective medical treatment due to the whole medical system, everything else. And they're saying, I can't live this way any longer. They're referring to their poverty. The whole story about the food bank, when a food bank, person running a food bank is alerting the media that we have a problem, that we have people coming to the food bank who are going to their doctors asking for medical assistance of dying because they're saying, we're living in poverty, we can't handle this any longer. You got a serious problem. Because they're being approved for death. They're being killed. But the reason they're asking for it is because of poverty. Is this an issue where we should be killing people for social reasons? And that's what it comes to often.
Again, I would imagine that those in favor of introducing the assisted dying bill would say, well, you're picking the most extreme cases here, just to prove your argument.
They're picking the most extreme cases to start with, because, you know, when you actually look at the data, Yes, of course, there are some people who are going through a significant, difficult condition. They're suffering. There's no question about it. I'm not, you know, and I've talked to a lot of these people. We have a helpline. We get calls from people. I've talked to several of these people on the phone who are going through significantly difficult situations. I'm not denying that that exists. But when you actually look at the data, they're the small minority. Okay, they're the small minority. Most people are actually properly cared for pain. Most people might have fear of future suffering, or they're fearing for what's coming, or they're, you know, this is what they're dealing with. They're reacting to the fear of what might be, or they're going through a situation where they don't want to be a burden on others, or they're saying, you know, I'm not happy with my current life experience because of my development of this type of a disability or whatever that might be that's related to their medical condition. But this is not the same thing at all, and yet this is why people are dying. They're not dying because they're in extreme pain. That's such a rare case. But it is, yes, a reality. But that's what they're selling to you. You know, the other side's argument is easy because none of us want to suffer. I don't want to suffer. I agree with you. But once you open the door and you say, well, we will go through this door. We're going to legalize this because we're of our fear of suffering. There's another door behind that. And that other door is not a pretty door. And that's where you're going to end up. Because you can't not get there. And the reason is we're dealing with humans. We all go through different cases, different situations. We all go through different difficult times of our life. Once you put killing into the mix, it doesn't become very pretty anymore.
Dr. Duncan Gehry is a consultant geriatrician working for but not speaking for Manx Care.
I am not speaking on behalf of Manx Care because Manx Care has no policy on assisted dying, but I am able to speak as a private individual and as a doctor on the Isle of Man. So speaking for myself as a private individual.
The situation described by Alex, the situation in Canada, it was quite quite surprising. But isn't this just a case that he's picked through some of the worst examples he could find of how assisted dying doesn't work in Canada, just to try and effectively scare the horses? And you know, in essence, there are the majority of the Manx population, according to opinion surveys, are in favour of this. So surely the MHKs are right to crack on with the bill.
Alex did paint a very good picture of some of the concerns raised by the Canadian experience, and even if he's only pointing out the worst ones that come to the media, there will be an awful lot more cases that go below the radar that aren't identified. So no, I don't think it's acceptable to dismiss the cases where people have died unnecessarily, inappropriately, in the attempt to give some people the choice to end their life at their time of their choice. So no, I can't dismiss that. And in my view, I don't think it's acceptable to contemplate a law that inevitably will lead to death of people that shouldn't die, to give some people the autonomy to choose that they should. This is fundamentally where I have a problem with assisted dying, that it is an offer for the minority that may affect significantly the majority.
You are a consultant geriatrician, and obviously you probably deal with more people who are most likely going to be affected by this law if it's introduced. What concerns do you have? And I say that because I know you have concerns because you raised them in the discussion this evening.
I suppose a big concern can be articulated by the one person who I know is out there who's giving a very good reason to support assisted dying is Esther Ranson, because she's the person with authority, with autonomy, with agency, who can articulate her own point of view. But my great concern for a lot of people that get bought into assisted dying is that they're not her. They don't necessarily have the same support. They haven't got the same strong mental health. They haven't got the same things around them to allow them the chance to make those decisions. And people in positions of vulnerability can make decisions that they may later regret. I mean, we've all been people that have said, well, I wish I didn't do that. Ultimately, in this conversation, people are making a decision that ends their life. They don't get the chance to undo that. So I'm really worried about people in vulnerable states choosing something they might live to regret. And all the Canada experience does seem to evidence that can happen and does happen. For a long time in the United Kingdom, I worked in London hospitals, and I had a lead role in Mental Capacity Act teaching and using. So I've got a long history of using capacity legislation in the United Kingdom before I came over 4 years ago. And despite the fact that I was one of the people that knew the most about it, did it most a lot more than other people, there are times when it's incredibly difficult to know whether someone has the capacity to make a decision or not. And the times when I personally found it the most challenging was when somebody has either psychiatric or psychological issues that underpin their inability to make the decisions for themselves. So if somebody with a lot of time and exposure to capacity legislation struggles with some aspects aside of the balance of probability, we haven't actually introduced the law properly yet. And to ask the doctors in the Isle of Man who haven't been exposed to it to suddenly become good at it, no, I don't think this gives a safeguard at all. I'm very worried that we won't be able to do the job properly or well for some time to come. I'm aware that the UK, 7 years after the introduction of the Mental Capacity Act, the Law Laws, I think it was, reviewed it and found that although the law was a very good law, the United Kingdom wasn't using it very well. So the idea that the Isle of Man will suddenly miraculously do it very well, I don't see that being realistic.
And when you say not using it very well, what does that mean?
Presumptions of capacity where there shouldn't be. Professionals still didn't understand how to use the law properly, even 7 years after the event, that it wasn't widely enough used and understood to do the job properly. Certainly in terms of decision-making about capacity, whether someone lives alone at home, there was an idea that, for example, social workers would often agree with somebody when they wanted to go into a form of care that was the right one, even if they don't have capacity. And doctors frequently decide that people don't have capacity when they didn't agree with them, because obviously we know best. So there was certain professional groups weren't using the law as well as they should.
And I suppose when it comes to deciding on whether people have the capacity to make decisions about their personal finances, it doesn't matter so much if the person making that assessment gets it wrong. But when it comes to assisted dying, maybe it's a bigger and more important issue.
It's not very reversible. So yes, I think I'd agree with you on that one. If we're allowing someone to make the choice to end their life and they didn't have capacity to do so, then we can't go back and undo that.
In relation then to medical staff having or undertaking this function, if the law is introduced, and it does look quite likely that it will be, bearing in mind the significant support in the House of Keys, certainly for the principal stage, the second reading of the bill. So how is this going to work if effectively doctors are governed by the General Medical Council, which is a UK-based organisation, and if assisted dying isn't legal in the UK, how does that work for the Isle of Man?
My understanding is that the GMC's position is that they go with the law of the land that the person works in. So if I'm a resident on the Isle of Man and I live on the Isle of Man and the law on the Isle of Man allows this to happen, then they won't prosecute me for doing it. However, there is an interesting interface with the United Kingdom that all of our cancer care, we relate to the United Kingdom. So there will be doctors in the United Kingdom who live and work in the United Kingdom who may be asked to give a prognosis for somebody who lives on the Isle of Man. But if they perceive that prognosis may be used in assisted dying, and they know that, the GMC may take the view that they've broken the law and there may be sanctions for them. So you can reasonably predict that the doctors in the United Kingdom who assist with the care of the residents of the Isle of Man may be very unwilling to give prognoses, which is a valuable part of ongoing care. So I think there will be consequences. What they all are will have to come out of the woodwork if we go down the route of doing this, but there are reasonably foreseen challenges that we need to address.
In relation then to people who perhaps are in a position where they would like to be able to make the decision to die, What are the alternatives at the moment that are available for them? And presumably you think that these alternatives are better than the option of just being able to say, actually, I've had enough of this and I want to end my life.
That's a very good question. The law at the moment allows anyone to make choices for themselves about their body, and I think the one thing that the medical profession hasn't always been very good at historically is offering people the choice to say no, I don't want that. I mean, certainly one of my significant bits of work these days is to ask people what they want. And because I'm a geriatrician, many people are in the later stage of life. And it always fascinates me and sometimes surprises me the number of times there's someone sitting up in bed looking very well, about to go home, and I say, look, you've been in hospital, do you want to do this again, effectively? And they turn around and go, absolutely not. And I say, but really? They say, no, I don't want to come back to see you again. But do you know what that means? Yes, I may die at home, but that's my choice. And we're trying very hard to allow people the autonomy to make choices at the time of their choosing with the information at their disposal so they can decide what they don't want. So my view to allow a dignified and natural death is to try and give people the choice when they're able to make that choice, to write that choice down, to allow people in the future to make decisions for their care at the right time in a supported way. I mean, we need everyone to know what we're doing. We need to communicate with the families and the relatives, if they care home, if they live there, the general practitioner, and everyone needs to know what this person wants for themselves. But it allows us to be dignified, and it allows us to allow natural death if that's what the person has chosen.
PLMHK Kate Lord-Brennan attended the meeting and has several concerns about Dr. Allinson's bill.
Well, I suppose tonight, the contributions from the speaker from Canada, who was talking about how these laws are working and the impact that they have in Canada, as well as the gentleman from who's a doctor, looking after elderly people. Those contributions to me just reinforced some of the things I've already been stating in the House of Keys, which we have to think very, very seriously about our responsibility as legislators. How this sort of move to bring in assisted dying under the proposed bill would work in practice, the impact that it would have on healthcare, the impact that it would have potentially on palliative care and elderly care. And also, it seems to me to be the case that it's not possible to prevent the scope of that from spanning out from an original intention in the bill. So I think the takeaway is a huge responsibility on legislators. Definitely need to think about how this would work in practice. And I think that this public discussion tonight has been very important.
Of course, Dr. Allinson would say that there are lots of safeguards in his bill. We did hear this evening, particularly from the Speaker from Canada, that similar safeguards were talked about when they introduced the legislation in Canada, but gradually, over a period of years, more and more of the safeguards seem to have been fallen by the wayside, particularly as a result of the whole situation about discrimination, that if someone with a condition that isn't covered by the legislation feels that they are being discriminated against, then the discrimination laws are effectively pushing the legislation into a much more open position.
Well, I think that latter point to do with the kind of equality argument, which was put as, well, you know, if that person can access assisted dying, well, why can't another person for another reason? You know, I think that's an angle that really hasn't been considered carefully by the House of Keys. On the safeguards point, I don't believe that there's safeguards in that proposed legislation. You know, I think there should be, but also how does that really work in practice? So very serious issues to consider and different angles that have been put forward to the public tonight.
We've heard this evening just one side of the argument, and I'm hoping to report soon from members of the House of Keys Committee on the Assisted Dying Bill, which is due to report back to the Keys imminently. So what do you think? It's rare in Manx politics that we consider matters which could have such a profound impact on our life and death. Let me know your thoughts on the programme by contacting Phil Gorn at manxradio.com and get in touch if you have any ideas for future shows. Don't forget, this programme is available as a podcast on Manx Radio's website. For now, I'm Phil Gorn. Goramayo. Thanks for listening.